welcome to another episode of Healthy Minds. I'm Julie, your host, and I've got one guest with me here today. Can you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Dr. Jason Schiffman.
Welcome, Dr. Schiffman. Can you please tell us a little bit about what you do?
I'm a professor of psychology and director of clinical training in the Department of Psychology at UMBC. I'm also the co-director of the Strive for Wellness Clinic, an early identification and intervention clinic within the Maryland Early Intervention Program.
Thank you so much for being here today. Can you tell us a little bit about the Maryland Early Intervention Program?
Absolutely. So this program is something that the state of Maryland supports to help young people who are in the earlier phases of psychosis. We offer treatment, assessment, education, research, and more.
Great. And I'm Julie, your host. I am the founder of Inquiring Minds LLC, which is a behavioral health and leadership training and workshops organization. And so we are going to hop into our topic today, psychosis. So Dr. Schiffman, can you tell us what psychosis is?
Absolutely. So psychosis is a term for a set of related conditions in which an individual's perceptions, thoughts, moods, and social interactions are all impacted and or somehow altered. Each individual experiences psychosis in a unique and sort of way in which they feel it themselves and will have a unique combination of symptoms or experiences, usually highlighted by a break from reality.
So these symptoms are typically broken into groups, right?
Yeah. The two groups are considered positive and negative symptoms. Positive not meaning something that you like or enjoy, but rather symptoms that represent some form of behavioral excess or behaviors and experiences that are present that typically would not be, including hallucinations and delusions, as well as disorganized speech or behavior. Negative symptoms reflect behavioral deficits or experiences that are absent but typically would be present, including reduced expression of emotions, reduced motivation to accomplish goals, and difficulty or lack of interest in social relationships.
So what does this look like exactly?
Delusions and hallucinations are part of the hallmark positive symptoms of psychosis. Delusions are ideas or beliefs that are held onto tenaciously, despite evidence to the contrary. Some examples of delusions include, I think people are talking about me, someone is following me, or aliens are sending me messages through the TV. They can exist on a severity of continuum, such that some thoughts are not that different from what people without psychosis would believe, while others are more significant, unusual, and clearly not based on reality. So delusions often share themes of suspiciousness as well as ideas of reference.
So what is a delusion of reference?
That's an idea or belief that something is about an individual when, in fact, there's no evidence that something that's going on is, in fact, related to them personally.
So thank you. The other common positive symptom that we see is hallucinations.
Yes. So hallucinations are perceptual experiences in the absence of sensation, such as hearing or seeing things that may not really be present. Hearing voices or auditory hallucinations tend to be the most common hallucination and also represent as being the most distressing for many individuals. The experience can include one or many voices talking among themselves or directly to the person experiencing them. Another form of hallucination is visual hallucination, in which someone sees something not present. Less frequent, but possible, include tactile hallucinations, that is, feeling something that's not there, like potentially bugs crawling, olfactory, which could be smelling something in the absence of a source, or gustatory, tasting something when you're not eating or drinking.
So is psychosis a diagnosis or is it a collection of symptoms?
This is a really good question. So psychosis is a broad term for a variety of related symptoms. Although psychosis is not a formally recognized diagnosis in the DSM or the manual in which mental health professionals use to diagnose and label folks, it does often mark a threshold level of severity of impairment in symptoms that can lead to a diagnosable label.
So what are the diagnoses that psychosis is linked to?
Psychosis is the hallmark for the so-called psychotic disorders, which include schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, schizophreniform, delusional disorder, and brief psychotic disorder. All these disorders are primarily characterized by the presence of psychosis and vary based on duration of illness or presence of other symptoms, such as mood symptoms.
Would you say that when people think of psychosis, they're typically thinking of schizophrenia?
Yes. So schizophrenia is really thought of as the hallmark psychotic disorder. When most people think about psychosis, they tend to be thinking about schizophrenia.
So aside from these psychosis-based disorders, they can be present in mood or anxiety disorders?
Yes, symptoms of psychosis can be present in other mental health conditions. Other disorders that can be present with psychotic features are mood disorders such as depression or bipolar disorder, as well as PTSD or post-traumatic stress disorder. The difference is that the main presentation of the other disorders is not psychosis. For example, those with bipolar disorder often experience distress and impairment related to an inability to regulate mood. At times, psychotic symptoms may be present, but never without a primary impact to mood regulation. Psychotic experiences may also be present as a reaction to trauma or loss, can co-occur with some medical conditions, can result from alcohol or drug intoxication, or can be related to sleep disturbances. In these cases, symptoms often remit or go away quickly without circumstances changing, but at times they can also persist or last.
So how prevalent is this?
Schizophrenia occurs in about 1% of the population worldwide. If you expand out to consider psychotic spectrum disorders, the prevalence can go up to about 3%. Roughly 2,000 young people in Maryland develop schizophrenia every year.
What do we know about psychosis and the quality of life?
We know that psychosis is associated with large impacts and often burden. Some of the things that we're concerned about include increased mortality for some folks. People with a diagnosis of schizophrenia on average live a life that's 20 years shorter than people without schizophrenia. Now, the reasons behind this shortened life expectancy are important to understand because some of them are addressable. Some of them involve lifestyle, so not getting physical health care that's needed, not being as active as a person without psychosis. Increased risk for suicide can shorten life expectancy. And ironically, some of the medications that are used to treat some of the symptoms of schizophrenia can also lead to physical health concerns that can shorten a person's life. Now, importantly, many of these concerns are addressable, and with the right treatment, we can mitigate some of that life expectancy loss. There's also a reduction in independent functioning, decreases in quality of life, impacts to the family functioning, increasing burden and stress to all those involved in the person's life. And there's also a broader global cost, a financial cost to society and the community, estimated to be over $155 billion per year in combination of direct healthcare costs and indirect costs such as unemployment or caregiving. I want to emphasize at this point and later on as we continue to talk that with good early intervention, we can mitigate or lessen some of these possible impacts and burdens of this disorder.
So, wow, first, and now that we know that psychosis has such a profound impact on people, let's talk about some of the warning signs.
Yeah, sure. So for early signs of psychosis, we try to think about signs on a continuum and to be sensitive to the subtle experiences of an individual symptom. We think about the progression of psychosis in terms of stages. So there's a prodromal phase of psychosis, which is a time before symptoms meet a diagnosable threshold, but where we can identify early signs. Then there's a first episode of psychosis where a person has passed a threshold, a diagnosable threshold, and is experiencing symptoms in a way that's very much impactful and that is causing distress or interference in their daily lives.
So what is a prodromal phase?
The prodromal or psychosis risk phase is a period of time prior to the onset of clinically diagnosable psychotic disorders in which the individual experiences functional declines and some signs of psychosis. Psychosis risk symptoms begin and develop with increasing number, severity, and frequency, often beginning around puberty. This phase lasts between 2 to 5 years on average.
So what are the risk symptoms? Psychosis seems fairly definitive. Either you're hearing voices or you don't.
That's a good question. So symptoms reflective of this period include attenuated or lessened versions of psychotic symptoms. These might include the feeling that something's not quite right or jumbled thoughts of confusion, declining interest in people, activities or self-care, and deterioration in functioning. Now, these are pretty generic or nonspecific issues that many people experience whether or not they're going to develop psychosis. There's also some that are a little bit more specific that are important signs that include attenuated hallucinations and delusions that tend to be less defined in the person's mind as they would be relative to having full threshold psychosis. And insight and doubt remains intact for individuals that are experiencing them at an attenuated or a lessened form.
And you actually collaborated on a prodromal risk screener. Can you give us an example of a question or a couple of questions that you ask on there?
Definitely. So a couple of examples include, I think that I have felt that there are odd or unusual things going on that I can't explain. I may have felt that there could possibly be something interrupting or controlling my thoughts, feelings, or actions. I wonder if people may be planning to hurt me or maybe about to hurt me. So you can see with these questions, there's some doubt built into them. I think that I may have, or I may have felt. So they're not full threshold, as opposed to, I know that something unusual is going on, or I know that someone's out to hurt me. There's some doubt in there. And though that sort of differentiates between full threshold psychosis and risk for psychosis.
Great. So you mentioned the first episode of psychosis earlier as part of the warning signs period. Can you kind of elaborate?
Mm-hmm. The first episode phase begins when symptoms get worse and pass this threshold for psychosis. Oftentimes, this is defined by the individual feeling convinced that her or his hallucinations and delusions are real, and then therefore they behave in a manner reflective of this real belief. Once the threshold is reached, insight and perspective are usually lost, and the capacity to function in an organized manner can become more compromised.
Okay, so it sounds like it becomes more difficult to treat once this threshold is breached.
That is an excellent point. Yeah, early identification and intervention really matters. I want to say that again. Early identification and intervention matters. In this field, there's a construct referred to as the duration of untreated psychosis. Sometimes you might hear the acronym DUP. But this is a time between when illness begins, the onset of psychosis, and when treatment is initiated. Unfortunately, on average, this period lasts over 2 years. I think that's reprehensible, and we need to do more about that. This longer DUP, or duration of untreated psychosis, is associated with negative outcomes, such as a requirement for more intensive needs for services, increases in negative symptoms, more social and occupational impairment, increased distress, and likely increased costs and burdens to the system more broadly. In addition, the longer treatment is delayed, the more obstacles build towards receiving needed help. There are more obstacles to enter the system, including challenges associated with insurance and lack of motivation or willingness by clients or patients. Additionally, if treatment is initiated after crisis, which is unfortunately all too often the case, poorly executed police contact or involuntary care can lead to a traumatic response to mental health services if that's the way in which it unfolds.
Yeah. So if you're seeing some signs and symptoms that are worrying you and a friend or even yourself or a family member, please seek help.
Definitely. Along those lines, there is really good news. The good news is that we understand the true value of shortening the duration of untreated psychosis and how it can open up opportunities for strength, resilience, and recovery. Although delays in care are associated with worse outcomes, fortunately, the reverse is also true. Early intervention helps. The sooner a person with schizophrenia or psychosis is identified and brought into a non-stigmatizing and integrated system of care, the better their short and long-term outcomes are likely to be.
So we've covered the warning signs and the actual symptoms. Can you tell us more about what might cause psychosis?
Well, genetics, sort of generally speaking, is really integral to a vulnerability for psychosis. We know less about the molecular genetics, although we have a very distinct understanding that this is a polygenetic disorder, meaning a lot of different genes are involved and a lot of different genes sort of manifest themselves in different ways for different people that may convey risk for psychosis. What we know with some definity is that having a parent with schizophrenia is a contributor. So that gives us this clue that genetics are playing an important role here. Now, the general population risk for psychosis is about 1% to 3%. If you have a parent with schizophrenia, the risk elevates to at least 10 to 12% for having schizophrenia. Furthermore, concordance between monozygotic twins, that is identical twins, is about 50%. So if a person is a monozygotic twin and their co-twin has schizophrenia, their risk for schizophrenia is somewhere around 50%, maybe just a little bit less. So this indicates two things, really. Both that there's a really strong genetic component to this disorder, but also that the environment plays a role too.
So I believe that's one of the strongest genetic links that we see in behavioral health conditions. What about unique environmental factors?
Although there remains a lot to learn, other vulnerabilities include environmental stressors, sort of broadly defined. These can include the experience of trauma. There's good research around the impact of immigrating to a country where a person is discriminated against as a minority as a risk factor for psychosis. Living environment and factors related to urban dwelling and living in cities. There's also non-genetic prenatal factors that may play a causal role as well.
Can you expand a bit more on the trauma and stress aspect?
There's a lot to this part of the story, and I'll only touch on some of it. But research suggests that biological responses, especially as it relates to stress, may play a role. Specifically, a prolonged activation of the stress response can elevate chemicals in the body that may increase risk for later development of schizophrenia. Stress can be triggered from many environmental impacts, but acute and chronic traumatic events appear to have the largest effects. There are also associated neurological features such as brain structure and functioning, often seen in psychosis, and the environment and biology really work together and sort of are brought in a way that synergistically can contribute to risk for psychosis and in the development of psychosis and in the experiences of psychosis.
That's fascinating. So you mentioned non-genetic prenatal factors. Can you elaborate on that?
Certain risk factors are related to impacts in utero or during childbirth. These are often related to any factor that somehow affects typical neurological or brain development and processes, which then later can lead to increased risk for mental health disruption, including schizophrenia or psychosis. Similar to stress during one's life, if the mother experiences ongoing stress while pregnant, such as malnourishment or trauma or illness, etc., it can impact in utero neurological development. Additionally, birth complications may play a role. Now, the mechanisms driving these factors are not yet completely understood, but we believe fetal hypoxia or a lack of oxygen to the in key times during neonatal development is a leading theory. It's important to note that the strength of these effects is relatively small, so that most pregnancies and most women who experience some of these issues do not end up having children who develop psychosis. But this does tell us a little bit about the etiology or the causes of some cases of psychosis.
Yes, and I've heard about drug-induced psychosis, which is its kind of own category there, but I believe that drugs can also be a risk factor.
Definitely. So as you're alluding to, many drugs can mimic the experiences of psychosis and in some ways, in some cases, cause psychosis. One that's particularly relevant to mention now is marijuana. There's been growing research to suggest that among people that have some sort of biological vulnerability to psychosis, the early use of marijuana can lead to an increased risk of developing psychosis later on. There's more to be understood around this line of research, but clinically, I tell folks if they're experiencing these subtle attenuated symptoms of psychosis to really try to avoid cannabis because it could be a certain trigger for them to develop psychosis ongoing.
So thank you for all of this wonderful information. Let's shift into what works well to treat someone with psychosis.
Absolutely. I think the bottom line take-home message I want to share here now and later is that there's growing evidence that treatment works and is helpful and can provide people a chance to live in the community, to live a life of their choosing, and to recover completely. So hope is a message that I want to make sure I get a chance to convey. There's two main forms of treatment that are sort of supported by evidence, and those include antipsychotic psychotropic medications and psychosocial therapy. So antipsychotics are medications. They're not a cure necessarily, but they do help relieve some distressing symptoms related to psychosis, specifically delusions and hallucinations. Medication is often taken in combination with psychosocial therapy, which you might think of as talk therapy, but also involves a variety of different approaches to helping a person. This can come in many forms, so family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, But research indicates that a team-based approach with a team leader who coordinates care that involves therapy known as cognitive behavioral therapy, as well as provides occupational and educational support, is the most effective. Sometimes this is referred to as coordinated specialty care. And really, it's the best approach to treating folks that are in early phases of psychosis. At this time, we have no like sort of surefire cure or even a way to prevent psychosis, but many people recover. And I believe that prevention is in some cases possible, if not forestalling or attenuating the ultimate outcome with good early intervention. These treatments help people recover and live lives of their choosing with dedicated work from the client, him or herself, mental health professionals, family members, and this team approach. Folks can really get better. Treatment improves every day with research. Research is helping, and there's growing hope for people that are impacted by psychosis.
It's great news. So let's talk a little bit about stigma and psychosis. So what are some common misconceptions about psychosis?
I think the first that I want to mention is this link between psychosis and violence. The media often portrays a unique and strong connection between people that have schizophrenia or psychosis and perpetration of mass shootings and homicides and some of the things that are very sensationalized and terrible in our society. What I want to emphasize is that mental health is only one of many factors that contributes to these things. And the link between psychosis and these horrible acts is very tenuous. It's estimated that only 1 in 70,000 people with schizophrenia is likely to commit an act of violence towards another person that leads to death or a homicide. 1 in 70,000, that's so small relative to stats such as 60% of people in the general population believe that schizophrenia is linked, or that a person with schizophrenia is very likely to commit one of these acts. Mm-hmm. So the discrepancy there is tremendous, and it's a tremendous misconception that I think we need to address. One of the reasons why we need to address this is because people themselves who have psychosis or schizophrenia learn these things and sort of begin to believe them in terms of other people fearing them. And so as a function of this internalized stigma, they may be less likely to seek help, less likely to get care, less likely to get treatment. And we know that if there is a risk of violence, treatment is a great prohibitor or deterrent for violence. But more broadly, treatment is just good for people. Early intervention is good for people. And if they're waiting too long because they're afraid to share, because everyone believes that they're going to be violent, then that does a disservice for them and others. I think it's also important to think about like how we define violence, how we define mental illness, and what we think of as like true risk factors for psychosis. Excuse me, not psychosis, but for violence. I can say with certainty that there are greater risks for mass shootings and homicides than psychosis. Some of these include substance use, in particular alcohol abuse. Mm-hmm. A history of violence is a far greater contributor to future violence than psychosis. Just basic demographics, like being a young male with access to firearms, these are risk factors that I think we should be more concerned about than psychosis. And again, this misconception or this leads to this stigma that prevents people from getting the help that they need. Other things that I think are misconceptions that lead to sort of negative outcomes include this belief that, or a belief that people with schizophrenia are all homeless. Many people with schizophrenia live and thrive and work in the community, work with or live with family members, and that all homeless people have schizophrenia. That's certainly not the case as well. There's misunderstandings about the disorder known as multiple personality disorder, sometimes referred to as dissociative identity disorder. This is very different. This is this idea like that different personalities live within the same person, wholly different from psychosis or psychotic disorders. And then the last one that I want to mention is this idea that people without psychosis or schizophrenia can't relate to people with psychosis, that they're wholly different. That they're unrelatable. Now, a lot of times I hear people say, well, Jason, I get depression. You know, I've been sad before. I understand anxiety. You know, I've been nervous giving a talk before. But I can't understand psychosis. That's something that I just can't relate to. And I like to challenge people on that because the more that we have an understanding that we're all connected, that we are more similar than we are different, the more likely we are to have an empathic and inclusive community that gives people the help that they need and helps them thrive. So I challenge people to think about their own experiences if they don't have psychosis, like maybe hearing your name called when, in fact, no one is around, or having this superstitions, another idea that's not necessarily grounded in fact or science or reality. The belief that that when you wake up from a dream, sometimes people have these dreams that are so intense that they're not sure if it really happened or not. Mm-hmm. You know, common experiences that many of us have that we can use to relate to people that have psychosis. Now, I want to preface that those experiences aren't as severe or significant or impairing as the symptoms of psychosis, but they can create a bridge.
Great. Thank you so much for that. So what is one thing that you wish people knew?
Hope. I want to emphasize this notion of hope. If we can identify people who might be on a trajectory towards developing psychosis early, or find people who are in their earliest stages of developing psychosis, and we can lend them a helping hand, we might be able to alter their trajectories in really significant ways, give them a chance to live in the community, give them a chance to live a life of their choosing. The technology, the science, the therapies have all grown in ways which allow us to provide folks help and hope in ways that we haven't been able to in the past. So I want to communicate hope.
Thank you. So we're going to share some resources really quickly. So one is the Maryland EIP website, which is marylandeip.com. They have some really wonderful resources on there. Do you want to share a little bit about
it? It's great. It's a great place for a resource. The website is fantastic. There's also a warm line or a consultation line that you can call. What's that number again, Julie?
877-277-6347.
If you have questions, don't hesitate to give us a call.
The website also has some really nifty free trainings on there, which is available to anybody that's mm-hmm. interested. And they sometimes offer some trainings for CEUs and credits and things, but not online. But I think they advertise some trainings occasionally that are available to the public.
Mm-hmm. And if you're interested in more CEU opportunities, just give that number a call or reach out in some ways. Some of the trainings there are informational and in-depth, but may not provide professional CEUs, but are great for learning about psychosis and a lot of other disorders as well.
Okay, great. And then as a reminder, if anybody's in crisis, to please call 911. And you can always call our favorite phone number in the history of the world, 1-800-273-TALK. That's the suicide hotline, but is not limited to just suicide. So we are going to wrap up here. So thank you all so much for listening, and a big thank you to our wonderful guest expert, Dr. Schiffman. Would you like to lead us into our self-care send-off?
Of course, I would be happy to. So if everyone would be willing to join me in a couple of deep breaths, I would love it. So maybe a deep breath through the nose, expanding the belly into the chest, all the way up, and then exhale out through the mouth. Maybe one more. And repeat as many times as you want.
So thank you again for joining me in this episode. Our September episode is going to be a special two-parter all about suicide. So I hope that everybody here has a wonderful August or month, whatever month you may be listening. And don't forget to practice your self-care.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.